Welcome to Recalculating Small Business.
What we think our small companies are worth, others will often disagree. At the same time, there's much to be learned about each company's financials. Here to talk about this and more is one of my favorite guests, Jerry Mills. He's the founder and CEO of B2B CFO. He's here because he has a fantastic new program for small business leaders to learn about the true value of their enterprise and more. Jerry, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
I understand you're in New York today talking to the Financial Writers Association, but you're also here to talk about your new program. Why don't I just turn the platform over to you and tell us a little bit about both things, and we'll go from there.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, we've created a new program called the Business Sales Solution, and the reason we created it is if you put yourself in the shoes of business owners who are thinking about possibly selling their business, what are their options? They usually go to seminars, and these seminars are put on by high-pressure salespeople. And these salespeople typically want something. They want a check for $35,000 to $60,000 so they can look at a company to see what it's worth. And our values are education, and so we've created this free educational workshop. We don't ask for any money. In fact, we advise business owners, don't write a check to anybody. And what we're trying to do is teach them, educate them on the pros and cons and also the traps of selling their business.
Well, keep on going. I'm going to start and then turn after this one question, then turn it over to Dan, because as you know, you might not know, but Dan knows I'm on the board of a medical marijuana nonprofit here in New Jersey, and we're in the process of raising money, and it's fascinating how people have come in and varied the valuation of our company, our nonprofit. In terms of their investment, my question to you is: what are the one or two things you should do first before you even start the process?
Well, before you even start the process, my advice to business owners is to contemplate what type of buyer would eventually buy them. I'm not talking about specifically a specific company. For example, would it be a strategic buyer? They usually offer the highest multiple or value. Would it be a financial buyer? Would it be a private equity group? What kind of buyer would eventually buy your business? And the reason that's important is because the type of buyer, again, whether they're strategic, financial, private equity, or whomever, offer different multiples of EBITDA, different valuations, in other words, and they do that for their own purposes. Strategic buyers, for example, will often buy at a very high level because they have a strategic motive. They may want to increase market share, they may want to acquire knowledge, they may want to prevent a competitor from coming into a market, and so they're less bottom line oriented in terms of a purchase. On the other hand, a financial buyer, or specifically a private equity group, are very financially motivated, and a lot of their reason is they want to buy a company at the lowest possible price so that in 2 to 4 years they can basically flip the company and make a return, and typically they're trying to get a return of 21% to 30%. So they're very motivated to cram the valuation down to its lowest possible dollar so they can flip it. So one of the things that we start out is sort of the saying, begin with the end in mind. Well, what do you want? Do you want a certain dollar amount? Do you want to maintain your employees? What are the values that you want out of the company? Is it a legacy company where you want the name and the legacy of the company to continue? Well, all of those values are subject to different types of buyers. And so what we do is, again, let's start out with the end in mind, and let's try to first find out what kind of buyer, what type of buyer is what we call it, is in your best interest, and then we go from there.
That's really a great answer. Dan, it's all yours.
Thank you. Good morning, sir, and thank you for joining us today.
Hi.
I have to tell you, I'm listening to your comments with Don, and I'm reminded of a friend of mine who's in the real estate business. And she and her, I've known her husband for decades, and just met her since we moved to Annabelle full time. But she's in the real estate business, and she said that when people want to put their house on the market, they have sometimes unrealistic expectations of what the property is worth. So she starts every by saying to the, let's get an independent third-party appraisal of what they would appraise the property.
Now, you're breaking up a lot. I'm having a hard time hearing the question. So was your question, am I seeing a lot of companies being started, or what was the other question?
Well, do we have a situation where do you see a situation where there's growing interest in starting businesses, and also interest recently where there are more businesses for sale than there have been for a long time? So are we seeing both things, both dynamics working right now, where we've got starting new and selling old?
Okay. Well, what we're seeing, obviously, startups are popular. There are a lot of barriers for them to get into the market today that didn't exist in the past. As far as the demand for companies that are selling, what we're faced with and what is something that we have that's never happened in the history of mankind, and that's the volume of businesses that are owned by baby boomers. And those baby boomers have a problem that their forefathers didn't have, and that problem is their children don't want to take over their business. They don't want to work as hard, or they want to do other things. And so just by the nature of the volume of baby boomers, we are seeing a lot of companies that want to sell. Now, wanting to sell and selling are two different things. Last year, according to Capital IQ, there were only 9,129 U.S.-based privately held companies sold, and that was an 8% decrease from 2015. And so we are seeing more and more interest of companies being wanting to sell, but the problem is they don't know how to sell. They have wrong financial information. They have the wrong advisors, and they are running into barriers in order to close a transaction. And so there's a lot of frustration, obviously. And we're actually seeing a decrease in the number of sales of privately held businesses because of this genre, this issue, that they don't know the process. They don't know who they want to sell to. They have wrong or bad financial information. They have an expectation of what the company is worth, and usually that expectation is materially different than what somebody will buy the company for. Now, that doesn't mean the value is not there. What it really means is, for the most part, they're not presenting the value the proper way, and they're not they don't have the knowledge in order to present a company that might garner a top dollar. And so there's high demand to sell. But there's these barriers the business owners put up in front of them themselves, basically, to prevent them from selling companies.
One of the
can I just jump in and ask a follow-up question? But, Jerry, what are some of the things that an owner should do to present the best possible put forward?
Well, that's a great question. Business owners, I teach them the catch-22 concept. They're in a catch-22. So they have they own a company, and for the majority, we're talking about U.S.-based privately held companies. And we live in a world of confiscatory taxes, federal tax, state tax, local tax. And some of these taxes can exceed 50%. And so they have a very big incentive to put personal and other expenses into their profit and loss in order to reduce their taxable income. Well, that may work in regard of reducing taxable income, but what that does simultaneously, and this is where the catch-22 comes in, it devalues the company. And so, and they don't understand that. They just say, well, wait a minute, we're trying to save taxes, therefore we're going to put some expenses in the P&L that we, or income statement that we may normally not put in order to save hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes. But they don't understand that doing that way, in putting aside whether that may be fit into the category of tax evasion, let's just put that away on the side. Just the fact of lowering their income, filing a tax return, signing it. Well, when a company comes in to possibly buy them, they use that lower number. And then if they're using a multiple of EBITDA or any other type of valuation that relies upon financial information, the company could be worth millions of dollars less than the business owner thinks that it's worth, and it's because of this genre of trying to save some dollars on federal, state, and local taxation. And it's a huge pitfall the business owners fall into, and then they don't understand the process. Sometimes in the market it's called normalization. They don't understand the process of how to normalize things to show the company what it would look like if those kind of expenses were not buried on the profit and loss statement.
Back to you, Dan. I just wanted to follow up.
Sure, no problem. In fact, I would agree with you, Jerry. My son tells me that the biggest problem that he sees in these small privately held businesses that he's trying to do ESOP transactions with is the reliability of the books in the company. But I want to go back to you and this new program that you have. Tell us how our listeners, the small business people, can benefit from your new service.
Well, this new service, they benefit significantly. First, we give them a complimentary copy of our book, the Exit Strategy Handbook. It's the best handbook in terms of education in the nation. And then we walk them through these processes. Okay, are you unintentionally devaluing your business, and what can you do to get it back valued back to the way that it should look like before a buyer comes in? And it's almost analogous to selling a home. Well, if you want to sell a home and get top dollar, usually we do things. We do the landscaping, we paint it, we may need to remodel the kitchen. Well, in the case of a business, we're not talking about painting the building and remodeling the flooring. What we're talking about is taking financial information, balance sheet, profit and loss statement, income statement, and first we're trying to see that it's accurate, because usually it's not. In my experience in doing this for almost 40 years, I've yet to go into a privately held company that issues internal financial statements to see them accurate. They're always wrong. Well, if they're wrong, and they're understated in terms of income, well, a buyer has a golden opportunity to buy something at a very much at a lower price. And so what we do is teach them, okay, let's first get accurate information. What does that even mean? Let's get timely information. What does that mean? Let's look at the best type of buyer. And the biggest thing, the biggest obstacle that we see is owners try to sell their business while they're operating their business. And that is a very difficult thing to do. And what they don't do is they don't surround themselves with team members who have been there, who have done that, that are working in the owner's best interest. And because an owner may be working 60 or 70 hours a week already, just taking care of normal business, you know, payroll, dealing with governmental issues, customers, accounts payable, HR, so forth. Now, if they do it by themselves, they're looking at another 40 or 50 hours a week on top of that. Well, that's a formula for disaster. And there are professionals that can be hired at a reasonable rate. A lot of times they'll take their fee at closing, conditional upon closing. And so they have an incentive to help the business owner close the transaction. And what the business owner needs to do is get, we call this a maze. They need to get through the maze in a specific period of time, but they need to have help, people helping them get through the maze so that they can operate their company properly. I have a statement in one of my books that 80% of failed transactions are because of declining financial activity during the period of which a buyer is looking at a company. 80%. So what we do is try to teach that and teach how to grow a business. In fact, when a company is going through a transaction, the number one goal, the number one job of a business owner is to grow sales and grow company value. Well, if they take their eye off the ball, if they're not dealing with their customers, their employees, and their costs, the company financial information is going to decline, and the buyer is either going to walk away or they're going to offer a significantly lower price, and that lower price may turn into millions of dollars.
We have to stop here a moment. Jerry, how do people find your website? Where are these seminars? Give us some details for our listening audience.
They go to our website, b2bcfo.com. That's B as in boy, the number two, B as in boy, CFO.com. And there's a place to register for the free free seminars, they can just sign up. We're in all the contiguous 48 states, and so we would just email them and invite them to the next seminar. There's no cost. In fact, we give away complimentary information, so they just go to our website and sign up and register for it.
We're here with Jerry Mills, B2B. CFO.com. He's got what I think is a wonderful new program helping people sell their companies, which listening to him and knowing a little bit about myself, it is a very difficult and arduous task. Dan, back to you.
Thank you, Don. Jerry, in the opening, Don mentioned that you're not only doing your free seminar, but you're in to meet with the financial writers here in there in New York City. What are you talking to them about?
I've been invited to speak to about 100 reporters tomorrow afternoon, and I'm trying to solve a frustration that they have. They are used to dealing with publicly traded companies, of which there are only 8,000. And of those 8,000, only 4,300 are actually traded on the market. Well, if you look at the privately held businesses, there's 20 million of us. There's 5 million with payroll of five people or more. There's 160,000 that have sales between 9 million and 350 million. And these reporters do not understand how to talk to us, because they can't go online and get financial information. They feel that there's a lack of transparency. And there really is not a lack of transparency. What there really is, and what I'm going to teach them, is there's a lack of communication, a lack of understanding. They'll demand, for example, and it's understandable why they do that, because they can go online for public companies and get a balance sheet and a profit loss, and those things are audited, and there's disclosure that the SEC requires. Well, they're expecting and they're demanding the same thing of private held businesses, and that's just not the way we work. We don't allow strangers to come in, regardless of how good they are. They may be with a very reputable magazine or TV station or newspaper, and ask for financial and other information. Well, we close down at that point and do not give information, and the press is frustrated. So what I'm trying to do is teach them the proper way to communicate with us so they're less frustrated, how to find out the really cool stories that are out with us that they don't hear because we're private. So I'm there to basically, they've asked me to talk about the gold or, you know, the really cool stories that can be found with privately held companies, and they're very frustrated about it. So I'm there to help take some of the frustration away.
So do you find that that's difficult for small businesses? Not so much that they need to release financial information, but sometimes they're too private.
Well, they are too private to a certain degree. And let me give you a very quick example. My company has been an award winner for 4 years on the Inc. 5,000 Fastest Growing Companies in America. It took my public relations firm 5 years to talk to me and let me disclose our sales. I didn't want to disclose any information. And so what I was doing is I was losing publicity and the opportunity to get awards from my company because I did not want others, particularly competitors, to know financial information about our company. So, yeah, we can be a little too private because getting in the Inc. 500, 5,000, getting other awards, and by the way, there's also a lot of industry awards. Most privately held companies are in industry groups, and what a wonderful way to be introduced to not only their peers, but for vendors, for people who have money, or potential buyers. So we can be a little too, we can hold things a little bit close to the chest, and sometimes it's not always in our best interest. So I would say this, that actually I have been guilty of that myself. So the answer to that is a resounding yes.
And that extends to family members.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
The playing it close to the vest, the owner, not disclosing a lot of information even to family members.
Well, the fear of a lot of business owners have, even when there's key management that may include family members, they don't want to release any information. One of the primary reasons is because let's say we have a profitable year. Well, if we disclose that information to key people, key employees, including family members, there's a fear, a sort of a built-in fear, if you would, that they may ask for more money, you know, salary raises, perks, an auto, or whatever it is. And that's usually not a correct fear. Most people work for a privately held business because they believe in the person at the top. I mean, they really believe in that person, and they're not there just for money. And sometimes we're guilty of that. The other thing that's difficult too with privately held companies in terms of disclosure as opposed to public, if you go online and see a publicly traded company, you see the bottom line is after tax, net after tax.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with a privately held company, if you see the bottom line, that's pre-tax because that money mostly is going to go pass through in an S-corp, an LLC, an LLP, a sole proprietorship. And so that number, and the business owner knows that, that's a false number in terms of somebody seeing it. Let's say the bottom line is $1 million. Well, the company really didn't make $1 million because that's pre-tax that's going to be passed through to the owner. And the tax may be 40 to 50%. And so we have a tendency to want to guard that almost to the bitter end, to not share information with people, and sometimes that is to our detriment.
Right. Let me.
Dan, I want to jump in because we're running close, and we promised Jerry that we'd get him off. But I have to ask a question: Are you involved when there are two or three children involved, and then? Either the founder dies or wants to give it away or pass it on. And what are some of the things you would suggest people do in a situation like that?
Well, at a minimum, the owner has to have Keyman life insurance to help perpetuate the company. So they have to have that. The other thing, the owner needs a plan, a succession plan, in the case of an uneventual death. That's what my company has. I have basically a board of directors, and if I prematurely die, There's a very large E&O policy. My company has no debt, but it's a very, very large E&O policy. And then we call them the executive committee. They'll turn into a board of directors. They know exactly my wishes. It's in writing. They know exactly what amount they need to pay to my estate, my family, my wife and children, if you would. And they also know that I want to perpetuate the company. And so that advanced planning is critical. And probably 99% of business owners don't do that. Is if you don't have advanced planning.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah. If you don't have the advanced planning, and let's say, for example, a business owner is single for whatever reason, divorce, wife died, well, then if they're not careful, the Internal Revenue Service is going to come in, and they're going to value the company, and they're going to ask for a pound of flesh. That's what happened to the Joe Robbie family. They lost the Miami Dolphins because Joe Robbie died, didn't have this planning in place. And so his family, which was supposed to inherit and run the Miami Dolphins, ended up having to sell the stadium and the team in order to pay the IRS the 50%+ that it wanted for the estate tax. So that advanced planning is critical. Otherwise, it just devastates lives. The employees, vendors, just family, everybody, just devastates lives.
Dan, you get to ask the last question.
I want to go back to the generational issue. You talked about how many baby boomers are interested in selling their business, but you also mentioned the fact that children and perhaps even grandchildren may not be interested in the business. How big a problem is that?
It's serious. Obviously, we don't have the stats on it, but I would say in being in business, that's the majority, and by majority, it's probably more than 60% or 70%. The children, they've seen their forefathers or their parents work, 50, 60, 70 hours a week. They don't want to work that hard. They don't want the business. They also want to work with gadgets and technology. And so the old days, 40, 50 years ago, it was just assumed that the child or children would take over the business, and today that isn't happening. And so there has to be more of an emphasis on what's going to happen. Who's the company going to be sold to? Is it going to be sold, for example, in a transfer in an ESOP to the employees? What's going to happen to the business? Because the children aren't going to take it over.
Wow. Thank you.
Jerry, you have to come. I don't know how you feel, Dan, but we have to have Jerry back to have another session. He's opened up some of the issues. But Jerry Mills, tell us again.
I'm sorry,
Jerry. Tell us your website and how people can reach you.
Well, I'm on the website. It has my emails on there. It's B as in boy, the number 2, B as in boy, CFO.com, B2BCFO.com. We've been around 30 years. Pretty easy to see us. Google us. It's very easy to find us. So, and we'd love to help any business owner that wants help.
Thank you for joining us, Jerry.
All right, great talking to you guys again. Thanks. All right, bye.
Bye.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Our next guest is an American success story. Alex
Desmalchi
is here to talk about his journey to success. Alex, welcome to our program.
Yeah, good morning. Good to be with you.
I was just welcoming Alex to the show. This is Dan Perkins. I'm really interested to hear your story. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to this country, what you've done since you've been here.
Yeah, good morning. So I came to California on July 22nd, 1987. Interesting how time flies. Came here from Iran. I grew up in a family of educators, both mom and dad, family of four. I have three other siblings. And after the Iran-Iraq war, we were here, went back after the revolution. And then shortly after the Iran-Iraq war broke out, unfortunately. So as a young man, at the age of 14, all young men were banned from traveling abroad. So I had to get smuggled out in order to build a future for myself and not have to end up going to war lines. So I came here in July of 1987, worked a number of small little jobs at a liquor store, worked my cousin's construction company, and I was studying after work, and shortly after I realized that this is a place for me to build my own business, build my own dreams. Instead of following the path that everybody else followed, I decided to create my own path, if you will. So through a series of learnings, failures, associating with some wonderful people, I started a bunch of businesses, and I landed on this last one about 6 years ago, where we manufacture and we own a portfolio of consumer products and beauty, oral care, personal care, fashion accessories, and we're fast-growing and enjoying it.
That's a nice outline, but we sure would like to hear some details. You were smuggled out. You did a series of things leading up to this. But what have you learned in those years that made you the success you are now?
Yeah, quite a bit. First and foremost, I kind of never believed that, you know, you have to be in the same box that everybody else has created. I look at life a little differently. And for me is, how can I hack it? How can I come up with something new in terms of innovating? And innovation applies to everything, the way you do business, the way you manage your life. So I didn't want to operate in the same pigeonhole that everybody else did. Rather, I created my own ideas and my own path to success, if you will. For me, having the right mindset for growth and success was really important, and I started associating myself with some wonderful people who had tremendous success, and learning from them on a day-to-day basis. And there was a lot of failure. I was never afraid of failing. I think mindset is extremely important. You know, for me to come here as a foreigner, I barely spoke a couple of words of English, and I was almost 18 years old. I was very welcomed. It was surprising. I didn't know how the folks here in California would welcome me and how I'd be able to live, but I felt extremely welcome. I felt like there were some generous, wonderful people in my life that came to my life, and they picked me up and they taught me things. So that was fantastic. And the mindset that I was talking about is the self-limiting thoughts. I, growing up, for whatever reason, you know, coming from a good family, I never had any self-limiting thoughts. I always thought that everything was possible, that life is, we basically started in our own minds what we can and cannot do. So with that, the basic rules and principles of running and operating business, I learned that it was pretty much the same no matter what you do. So applying those basic principles allowed me to become successful and staying true to my you know, again, taking it back when we got into the product business, it was at the bottom of the economy about 7 years ago. We started off with the mindset that we have to bring products to consumers that we would buy ourselves, that we would use ourselves, at a value that we believe is fair and right, that our family and our loved ones would use it. So I think honesty is extremely important. Not having a mindset of, you know, if you get up and you think something is not possible, I guarantee you it's never going to happen. But if you believe that it is possible, and if you put one foot in front of another, great things will happen, and pretty much everything is possible, especially in today's world, that access is so cheap. My 18-year-old could get online and he could build a business from scratch in a matter of a few days. He can source products. He could use technology that is widely available and that is cheap. So, but in 1987, it wasn't as easy as it is today. So that's been the pillar of what we've built. And I've surrounded myself with wonderful people. Our team members are great. I feel like if I'm the stupidest person in the room, that's the room that I want to be in. So the people around me are just absolutely great, and they're smart, and they're hardworking, and they're people of great value.
Dan, it's up to you.
Okay, Alex, I want to step back in time in 1987. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you got into the country, but you arrived, and you said you went to California. In the first 30 days that you were here, what was the impression? Was it different than you thought it was?
As soon as I arrived, I lived with my cousins in West L.A., and I immediately had a job 3 days later at a liquor store right by UCLA. I don't know if I'm following what your question was because of, again, connection issues.
You're doing a fine job. Go ahead.
Great. So what my thought and belief was, you know, again, at 17, at the age of 17, 18, coming into a new country and not speaking language, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear of unknown. There's a lot of fear of connecting with people. Brand new culture that I didn't know much about. I was here at the age of 9. I was in fourth grade. You don't remember much from that age, or you don't learn much about culture. But blending in with the culture and speaking the language alone was a challenge. So I got a job at a local liquor store, and I was stocking up the refrigerators. And this was right by UCLA. And I started picking up ESL classes and trying to learn how to speak the language and understand the culture. That was my first order of priority. And I was there for about a couple of months. I had a cousin who had a construction company, and I was going to go to Pierce College in the Valley. So in the meantime, I started working with him as an assistant electrician to this electrician guy that he had. And through interaction with people, then language got a little better. Still broken today, but it got a little better. And then understanding, you know, finding friends and place that I knew two people, literally, my two cousins. That was fun, and it was also challenging at the same time. As I worked for my cousin and I, again, worked the liquor store job, I kind of looked around, and I got fired, actually, by my cousin. Going back in memory, I got fired by him because I wasn't much of a good electrician, or at least he thought. That was a nice kick in the pants. That was the start of my thinking that I have to be in business for myself. I want to control my own destiny. And I learned the trade fairly quickly. And at the age of 19, I started my own construction company and started picking up odd jobs, which led into some bigger jobs by the age of 20. So I'm a serial entrepreneur. I have no fear of getting into different lines of businesses. Again, going back to the principle being all the same, I've been able to apply that in business. And like everybody else, I've had a lot of successes and I've had a lot of failures. But my failures taught me the great lessons, not my successes. I think most... the most brilliant lessons in life are the ones that come, they're the most expensive ones.
So 6 years ago, 8 years ago, you made a significant change in your life in creating your new company. What is the new company called?
It's called Dastmalchi, D-A-S-T-M-A-L-C-H-I. That's the umbrella company. And underneath that, we have, if you go to the website, dastmalchi.com, underneath that, we have some really awesome brands. One of them is called Vanity Planet. It's a entry-level beauty line, 95% female audience, if you will. We have Dazzle Pro, which is an oral care line. We bring products in and compete with Oral-B and Philips Sonicare. We're typically about half the price of what they retail for. We have a new watch line called Bradford, which is some simple, nice watches. Again, quality is of very importance to us, and then value goes right after that. We just helped launch one of the Orange County housewives, had a dream of building her own business, and she had it for a few years. She was missing some of the infrastructure things that we have in our company, and we helped her launch her handbag line. Her name is Gretchen Christine, so it's GretchenChristine.com. And I'm having fun looking at what else we can bring to market, utilizing some of the same infrastructure that we've built.
So you're basically totally web-based? You don't do bricks and mortar?
We do some bricks and mortar. We do some teeth whitening for CVS. We private label for them. We are in some Barneys, I believe. Yeah, we're in some Barneys. We're in talks with Neiman Marcus and all the other retailers. But selling online has allowed us to not just sell in the U.S., but we sell abroad as well. So our team here is in the U.S., which is fun because we get to create jobs here. But we get to send about 30% of our products that we ship out on a monthly basis, we send abroad. And it's grown. We started with sending, we celebrated our first two or three sales. Today, we do about 2,000 orders per day that we fulfill. So the business is rapidly growing.
And so you don't actually own bricks and mortar. You participate in bricks and mortar, but you're primarily a web-based company.
Yes, we're primarily a web-based company because, as you know better than I do, there is extreme growth online versus retailers are challenged and with having a huge infrastructure and their overhead. And we're able to actually cut costs that our consumers are able to enjoy that. I don't think that any product should be burdened with unnecessary marketing and massive retail stores and the rents that come with it. So going back to the philosophy of the business is, again, like, how do we get a product to someone at a good value? And you could only do that if you cut all of your unnecessary expenses. So we've cut waste out, quite a bit of it.
We're talking with Alex Dastmalchi. He's a serial entrepreneur. Right now, he's involved online with, if we heard correctly, handbags, women's various toiletries, etc. But Alex, I'd like to ask you one question before I turn it over to Dan. Well, I just saw some figures last night that said that even amongst the millennials, they still 59% still prefer to buy in a store, and that 73 to 83% of other age groups still prefer to buy in a store. And admittedly, you're growing, as are many other people online. What do you think that means, if anything, Alex?
Yeah. So, great question. So, I don't think retail stores are going to go away, and they shouldn't. It's fun. It's great when people go in and see the actual product. I think that you have to have a strategy to do both online and offline. It's changing. The landscape is changing. Some of the retailers are going to change the way they do business. And eventually it's a place that we'd like to be in more and more. But the challenge being in retail for us, when we started this business, and we started it with basically nothing, with not a whole lot of resources, and not much in capital at all. The challenge in retail in today's world for people like us that are starting a brand, or any young person who's starting a brand, is shelf space. You have some of the massive companies who've taken shelf space, and they're doing a great job, but there's so much physical shelf space available at these retail stores. So getting on it, it's going to be extremely difficult. So we took a different approach. Our approach was that if we do a good job online and we create demand to the same percentage of people that you just mentioned, and if they really genuinely like our product and that catches fire and goes viral, then we have a much better chance and an opportunity to go to retail and tell them, here are our products, here are the people that are buying it. And we've created the demand online because there's the digital shelf space, as you know, is much larger. Therefore, after that, having a strategy to have those products on the retail shelves. Does that make sense?
Very much so. I'll turn it over to Dan now.
I'm fascinated in the as a registered investment advisor and looking at businesses for over 40 years to invest my clients' money. Looking at your model,
would I have still started the business? Would that be the question?
Internet wasn't there.
Yeah. So assuming the internet wasn't there, I still would start my business. Internet is here today. Tomorrow it's going to change. The landscape of e-commerce and doing business online rapidly changes. With artificial intelligence and bots and whatnot, the way we do business, we're online on the internet now, and we're looking at a screen. Tomorrow we'll be using our Alexas in our home. We're using artificial intelligence and talking to our phone and ordering products as we drive. So absolutely, I would still start it. When there is a will, there's always a way.
The thing that concerns me, Alex, is that the data that I've seen is that the Retail Merchants Association estimates that 8,500 storefronts will be closed in 2017. We have seen a number of national brands close their shops, go out of business. So that the retail space appears to be increasingly more expensive to even stay in. And when you've got 8,500 storefronts that are going to close this year, as the internet becomes more and more powerful as a source of distribution, I don't think that trend is over. I think you're going to continue to see business, big box business, close and profits decline. Big operations, Macy's is closing several hundred stores. Sears and Kmart went out of business, and so that the whole retail space is dramatically changing. But the physical experience, which you talked about, is somewhat important. It wraps me up, and all just amazing how many stores are empty. I don't think there's going to be new.
Right, and it's sad in some cases, and I completely get it. And Macy's is having a difficult time, yet Nordstrom's is innovating and they're enjoying growth still. So there will be more closures. I completely agree with you, because it is expensive to operate a retail brick and mortar store. The overheads that are coming with that are enormous. So they have no choice, retailers, but to sell a product for more of what it's being sold online. On the flip side, a little bit of that is changing by you know, having pop-up stores. So instead of people bringing in a massive, building in a massive infrastructure and having huge retail, they're doing these little pop-ups, and Macy's has got this uber creative space that they're bringing new brands in. So it is sad to see those jobs go away, extremely. However, on the flip side, online, and it's not over, you're right. There's going to be a lot more of that. But then online, as you see, there's a lot of new companies, Dollar Shave Club, perfect example. These guys started it with almost nothing. They had a great billion idea, and now they're a multi-billion dollar entity. Big brands are not enjoying massive growth yet. Again, it's allowing for good competition. You'll have kids, a couple of kids literally, that will come up with a great product or a great idea or a great e-commerce business, and they're able to compete with Procter & Gamble. So the competition is not, in the retail business in the past, it would be some giant retailer would come in and wipe out another retailer. Best Buy, Circuit City, you know, there's quite a few of those. Home Depot came in and wiped out a lot of small businesses. So that shifted and changed, and I think it's kind of going the opposite direction. You don't see much of the giant business coming in and taking out another giant business or a bunch of small retailers. There's all of these small micro e-commerce businesses that are coming in, but together they're creating a massive wave. They're taking away a lot of the market share from the giant retailers. And that will stabilize. Again, I think that eventually there's going to be a time where people will enjoy retail. The retail experience is going to be a little different. And it's coupled with e-commerce as well.
Alex, as the retail consumer and an online consumer, one thing that we have talked about with a lot of people on this program is that the problems that the big box stores have is they forgot customer service. The online retailers live and die by customer service. And it seems to me that if the big box stores are not going to get back to serving their customers and caring about their customers in the store, fewer and fewer people are going to go to those stores.
Yeah, you're very right. And the reason for online great customer service is accountability and transparency. If you go to a big box store and your customer service is bad, what would you do? There's no board for you to go and write your name on and give them a star review. Yet online is extremely, it's a very transparent way of doing business. If you bring a product to market, and retailers are all about, you know, doing business is all about profit, and everybody should be about profit. But if you have a product on the shelf of a retail store and the product is not of good quality, or if you don't get good customer service, again, where would you go? You might go to an online place and post a review that is not, you know, favorable. However, in the world of online, and I love this, I think that transparency holds everybody accountable. Without it, there would be complete chaos. If we don't operate well, if we don't take care of our customers, immediately, the business is just not going to grow. People, in the sense of community, they're able to see how each e-commerce site performs. Amazon is a great example of fantastic customer service. I don't know if you buy products from them or not, but I have. A few days ago, I received a package, and it was broken. It was a bottle of this oil. It was broken. I go on the website, and I click somebody to call me, and it's not just digital. By the time I finish clicking, my phone rings, and I get a full refund and an apology.
Alex, I'd like to jump in here and ask you on this issue. People talk about that final mile, the last mile between you and the store. All of you are dependent, except, well, even Amazon, on the various FedEx, UPS, et cetera. But you're, in effect, dependent on them being efficient deliverers of your products. And it's out of your hand. What do you think is going to happen there?
Yeah, so there's great innovation happening in the space of logistics and delivery, and it's only going to get better. We use a pretty large company, Ingram Micro, to help us with fulfillment, and they're best in class. And the way that innovation is moving along, and Amazon has is coming in, the industry still, believe it or not, it's pretty good. You buy a product, you can have it in your hand or in your home 2 to 3 days. But there are so many great innovations, and the entire logistics is still behind, way behind in terms of technology. There's a lot of waste. Now that UPS truck is bringing a product in, I kind of see my UPS guy coming to my house, and then he comes back 2 hours later to drop off another package. So there's still a lot of waste. With the help of technology, with the help of machine learning, they're getting a lot better. And I think that logistics, Amazon has this fantastic service called Prime Now. I've ordered products from it. You buy it today, somebody will go pick it up for you and will bring it to your home. So again, I'm a big fan of retail space. I enjoy it. I enjoy going there with my family, with my son, looking at a physical product. The challenge is, how are they able to sell these products at the same value as you can purchase online? But with logistics changing, they're going to be able to use their facilities as distribution centers, and I believe Walmart is about to do that, where they're going to allow their employees after they clock out, kind of like Uber, be able to deliver packages and earn extra money.
Dan, back to you.
Alex, what's in your creative brain? Is your creative brain for your next opportunity?
The next opportunity is to push the envelope as hard as we can, and not only take the products that we use every day, a lot of products that if you look around your home and products that you use in your daily routine, that's the area of our focus. A lot of them need significant improvements. So we're working hard and trying to improve. The second piece of business that we're looking at is how can we, as an American company, how can we establish ourselves better globally? Again, with access with the internet, how can we get into a lot of the emerging markets? And China being one, right? China actually not an emerging market. They're number one in e-commerce. I wish we had more time to get into that discussion. I don't believe it's fair trade. Someone could sit in China and they'll be on Amazon in a matter of minutes and they're able to ship products in the U.S., yet, as an American company, we cannot sell in China. There are tons of regulatory hurdles that made it extremely difficult for us to do so. So that's a challenge that we're trying to solve. But all of our challenges are fun. They're great. And we're trying to overcome them one at a time.
It's been a breakthrough in China. It used to be in China, if you wanted to sell in China, you had to strike a partnership relationship with a Chinese company. And China just recently announced that they're going to lift that restriction as it relates to automobiles. They're going to allow the global automobile industry to come into China and not have a partnership requirement. And a lot of people are interested in how that play out.
Yeah, I believe it's very important. And there's no stopping it. It's going to happen right now. People are sending products cross-border into China. I don't believe that they're stopping it at all. It's going to open up slowly, but it's kind of difficult when we buy products from China, and they're great products. They're great partners of ours, and they have an opportunity to sell into our country very easily or to our customers. I think that we have to have the same. Unfortunately, today it doesn't exist. Being partners, even with a Chinese company, and at least in our business, in our model, that won't solve it. We would have to file, for instance, for a WOFI, which is a wholly owned foreign entity. After that, we'll have to file a bunch of trademarks. After the trademarks are done, we would have to establish ourselves there for a few years before we can get on their e-commerce platform. So literally, there's so many hurdles, and it's so expensive that it makes it almost impossible for a small business like ours to get in today.
Alex, you've been a wonderful guest, but we have to move on. We've been talking with Alex Dasmaki and his journey from Iran to America and to success. And again, Alex, your website and how people can reach you?
Yeah, we're on www.dustmalchi.com, D as in David, A-S-T-M-A-L-C-H-I, where we have a collection of our portfolio available for folks to view.
Well, Matt, a link to his website will be on our webpage, www.recalculating.biz.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.